Hi, folks. My name is Chris, and I'm the artist and co-founder at Explorer Maps.
Hi, this is Vanessa, Chris's wife. I have been a number one fan of Chris's art since I first met him in the late 1990s. Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploremaps.com.
Welcome to The Trail Less Traveled, an adventure radio series and podcast dedicated to collecting stories and sounds from around the world in order to take you back to mankind's earliest form of entertainment, storytelling. This episode was recorded on location in collaboration with Explorer Maps. Missoula, Montana is a mecca for outdoor enthusiasts, and each week we will bring you tales of adventure from both near and far, as well as information and inspiration and a few tunes to set the mood. You can subscribe to the podcast and learn about our international outreach projects at traillesstraveled.net. And now, here's your host, international expedition guide, conservationist, and yogi, Mandela.
We are sitting on the main Salmon River. I'm watching an osprey fly overhead with a massive fish in his talons. An amazing catch that we just observed as we float down the main Salmon River. I'm rowing the boat today. It's the last day of a six-day salmon recovery riding workshop with the Free Flow Institute and David James Duncan. David is sitting on my boat right now. So in the background, you may well hear the sound of the rapids. And I'm going to go ahead and honor Mike and Zoe for being here and holding space while we record this interview. Zoe's actually not just holding space, she's also going to hold the microphone because I'm going to be holding the oars. David, for those listening who don't see what you see right, could you paint the picture of where you are right now and what you're looking at?
We're in the Salmon River Canyon, in places maybe 3,000 foot hills on each side. The river's massive this year, incredible snowpack. It's dropped a lot, and this is our sixth day on the river. It's kind of taken over our minds, but we're also like, damn, we're almost to the end of this wonderful experience. The Salmon River's name, it makes obvious what it's famous for. It's in the middle of the largest wilderness left in the lower 48. It's also very close to a network of salmon spawning streams in that wilderness, pristine wilderness streams. 5,500 miles of them, the most famous maybe being Marsh Creek. And anyone who's seen those streams know that they're perfect birth houses for salmon, small multicolored gravel spawning beds in the headwaters of the salmon, snake, Columbia are where a huge number of salmon were always headed until the eight dams that now bar their path going and coming. And, of course, the ones we're all concerned about are the four lower Snake River dams, which are no longer needed at all for hydro. But I'm not going to do some kind of policy wonk talk here. I'm a pretty old guy, and I've seen some things that a lot of people have only read about or maybe even never heard of. One is, when I was 4 years old, my parents drove my uncle and my father and mother and aunt. We drove to Celilo Falls. And I remember just being stunned. It's 200 miles from the Pacific, and you feel like you're at the ocean. And the falls just reminded me like of storm surf on the Oregon coast, which I'd maybe seen once. Just in memory, too, I just always compare that huge sound. It was oceanic. And it was weeks or maybe a couple of months. It was very shortly before the Dalles Dam buried the falls, and there were Indians still on their dip netting platforms in their usual and accustomed places, and they were catching fish. And I was just mesmerized, but also confused by what, even as a very young child, I could see was a solemnity or sadness in their every gesture and on their faces. And I remember that when I got back home, we were using the hydropower to watch the Ed Sullivan Show the night Elvis Presley came on for the first time. So from watching these traditional peoples to You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog was a pretty weird stretch for a four-year-old kid. The second experience I had with salmon also is interesting to me, just because there was a little tributary of the Willamette. It runs about 26 miles out to Gresham. And my grandmother was a realtor, and she wanted to, you know, teach me the godly truth of the art of selling real estate. And I had no interest. And she said, "But you'll like this place." And I wondered why. Yeah, I was 6 or maybe 7 when this happened. And she said, "Creekfront property." When we got to the place where she was going to be holding an open house, she gave me permission. It was a pretty small stream. She gave me permission to go down to Johnson Creek. And I walked a ways downstream and came to a really deep pool in such a small stream. And there was a log kind of cantilevered by boulders so that I could kind of get out over the water. And I was just lying on the log being mesmerized by the foam lines that looked like constellations, when an enormous, I mean, for a little kid, it was probably, I don't know, it was probably typical size, maybe a 10-pound male coho with absolute Indian totem carving coloration, black, red, and white, came right up and glided right under me, maybe 5 or 6 feet away, staring at me with that unblinking eye. And it knocked me over. Kind of my story for a long time was being a guy who wanted to be a writer. So I had like 12 years as a starving artist and needed Portland for income. But I was always trying to move to a river. And when I did move to a river, it was a really nice salmon stream. But, well, I want to get back to where we are. There's places on this river which I no longer fish because they're losing their salmon and steelhead. They're right down to extinction numbers, and they won't last long at all unless some of the new interest in salmon legislation that has now made the connection, the vital connection to the southern Puget Sound orcas, isn't activated fast. I mean, every year that those dams survive is a disaster. There are some years where the temperature in the slack waters for 450 miles, the temperature is 78 degrees by, say, August. Baby salmon trying to smolts trying to migrate to sea die at 72 or 3. You know, there are lawsuits in place now. $15 billion in debt, bankrupt Bonneville Power Administration is violating all kinds of laws. The Clean Water Act is just being, I'm sorry, pissed on, you know. The fact that the Army Corps of Engineers and Bonneville Power Administration, the dam builders and maintainers, and the dam's financial beneficiaries are responsible for the way this incredible resource that's been with the tribes for at least 10, maybe 11,000 years and was a multi-billion dollar industry before dams begin to annihilate them. I mean, really, the attitude of the anti-dam removal people is really that they're working toward extinction. So to say we're loggerheads is an understatement. And I always try to remind people of certain stories, like the fact that all of Christ's disciples were commercial fishermen, and Jesus himself told them where to cast their nets after the crucifixion and resurrection. And the disciples did as he said, and they caught 153 fish in one throw of the net. And I just feel to have a kind of not exactly political wing of the federal government, the BPA, and the Army Corps, who, when they originally built Bonneville Dam, had no plans for fish ladders and were going to wipe out the salmon population of the entire Columbia snake system, to have them in charge of the salmon's policy and recovery efforts is a disaster. Like this rapid could be.
Intermission for the rapid. You're on the Trail Less Traveled. If you just tuned in, I'm on the oars. We're running the main Salmon River. We're talking with David James Duncan. He's an author and conservationist. I think that we're past that little riffle here. We're not in the studio. This is the studio today. Thanks for listening. Let's hand it back to David.
Little riffle. Yeah, right. I fish Montana trout streams, and I never get near shit like that. But I have fished the Salmon River. I've caught some beautiful steelhead in this stream back when it could still be done. But the last time I even touched an Idaho steelhead or an Interior West salmon was a long time ago. I don't even want to catch and release them with their numbers as incredibly diminished as they are now. I think one thing that occurs to me is just, I remember a time when if you went out on the lower Columbia and just fished off a sandbar, standing on the bank with a spinning rod, there would be a time of year, usually in September, where the surface of the Columbia, as far as you could see, in an area where it was almost 2 miles wide, and you could see, you know, tens of miles in both directions. I'm talking about mid-1960s. The whole surface of the Columbia would come alive around sunset with rolling salmon and sometimes leaping salmon and steelhead when the migration was pre-Lower Snake River dams. And the difference that made, their lack of ability to reach those 5,500 miles of pristine stream beds that are their birth houses, that are where they came from, and everything in them tells them that they have to return to that no matter what stands in their way. They really, their DNA leaves them no choice. It's just a loss that's really crushing to a lot of people. I think that what I really prefer to think about is the sense of wonder that they inspire in anyone who sees them in those birth houses. And a number of years ago, it might have been that same 2010 when I last touched a Clearwater River steelhead, I took friends from Massachusetts up a tributary stream of the Locksaw River where there was a salmon holding pool. It was two wonderful musicians, Jeffrey Foucault and Chris Delmhorst, and their daughter Hazel, who was seven. And Jeff wanted to fish for cutthroat in a pool, and I knew this was a good one, but I wasn't really expecting. I thought it was too early for salmon to have returned, but while Jeff was casting to cutthroat in the tail out, I looked upstream, and it looked like a platoon of Navy SEALs were swimming around in the pool. I mean, in that small water, a 25-pound spring or summer Chinook just looks enormous. And Hazel and Chris just sat on rocks where they could see the whole pool. They were made nervous enough by our presence that they started doing this beautiful thing that spooked salmon do when they're in an inland pool, unable to leave, unable to flee, because everything in them is saying the tail out of this pool is where we'll be spawning when the rain comes in the fall. Hazel drew beautiful little color crayon pictures of the Chinook that she spelled S-H-A-N-O-O-K when she got back to Massachusetts, and I still have her color pictures. And I think where this story really gets so tragic that you can only compare it to something like King Lear or the great Greek tragedians was when we already knew that southern Puget Sound orcas were really in trouble. But when Tahlequah gave birth to that calf that died in 5 hours and carried it on her nose as it disintegrated, decomposed, and still she kept carrying it for 17 days for 1,000 miles around the Salish Sea, right where their territory is. She was joined by her pod on day 9. They would hold the rotting calf, and so Tahlequah could rest, and I don't know, maybe she fed a little, but they were with her constantly, you know, grieving with her. For the tribes of the Sound, the orcas are their, I almost want to say, blood relatives. They don't see a separation between us and these unbelievably charismatic creatures. The orcas of southern Puget Sound, there are two kinds of them. They're the kind that eat seals, and they're the kind that eat salmon. But most of those orcas were salmon orcas, and the same dams that have kind of destroyed the fishing culture inland and also in all the fishing ports of Washington and Oregon near the mouth of the Columbia. Well, it's been a disaster. But the thing that really knocked me over, for several years afterward, I went back to the same pool where we'd seen 22 spring and summer Chinook. And for about 6 years after, I never saw a single salmon there or in any of the spawning areas that I knew on the Locksaw River. And I had spent a whole day looking for one spawning spring or summer Chinook salmon in those waters and found none. And I knew what Tahlequah was doing. And when I got home, I made the mistake of listening to a NOAA National Oceanic Atmospheric. I listened to their recording. They were following Tahlequah in the pod. And I heard the sound. Of her grieving the calf she was carrying. And I just have never heard such a beautiful, horrible, tragic sound. It put any opera you could name to shame. Any tragic play I've ever seen. I mean, all these art forms generate the same wonderful feelings. But to see something like this enacted by something that a lot of people consider a violent animal just because of its diet, I just can't think, as you can tell, I can't think of what that animal and that pod did without nearly losing it. And now we're back in another deadly rapid, so... Thanks for the nice rowing. I'm still dry. I can't believe it.
What you hear are the sound of the waves of the main Salmon River in the Frank Church Wilderness of No Return. You're on the trail less traveled. This morning we're speaking with David James Duncan about salmon recovery. And David, I would love to close with any parting statements that you have, potentially an excerpt from your book or a poem or maybe even a song that you think would be important for those listening to hear right now.
I haven't memorized it, but I wrote a version of Roll On Columbia, Roll On, which is often on bronze plaques at the site of all these dams. And the way people felt about dams when Woody Guthrie wrote that song was the way FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, felt about them. He just thought all dams were good dams, and the other things that dams support were just not being given any consideration. That FDR tendency has continued through a hell of a lot of Pacific Northwest politicians, and it reigns supreme, that attitude, in the state of Idaho, even though it would be of huge financial benefit to Idaho and particularly the whole river corridor, but poor Lewiston. It's the poorest region in the state, and largely it is the so-called seaport of Lewiston that has created that destitution. They have kind of a gutted downtown. A city that was once beautifully exposed to the Clearwater River is now behind these big Army Corps dikes that block the river from view completely. It's just been devastating to what culture Lewiston has, and it could be such a sweet town. There are viable plans that Mike Simpson and many others have stated about a really comprehensive kind of recovery that would take the farmers into consideration. It would absolutely replace the irrigation that would be removed from the current ditches with pumps, and so there would be no loss. There's incredible problems in those reservoirs with superheating. That's what kills the smolts. And also, they generate huge amounts of weeds, which turn to methane and are being pumped out, which is, I don't even remember how many times, more terrible for climate change than just CO2 and carbon monoxide. And also, nitrous oxide collects in the rotted material on the bottom of the reservoir that's being pumped out through the turbines. And to call that clean green energy is pretty naive. In fact, it's a blinkered eyesight, carefully blinkered for, I would say, mostly political reasons. I don't do politics, but it seems like that's what's happening. All I know to do is keep telling people why I love these creatures. And I wrote a novel called The River Why, in which one of the main characters is a female Chinook salmon with whom the protagonist, he follows her migration when his sweetheart hooks her on a leader so light that he can't fight her, so he can only follow her. And he feels his predatory instinct just dissolving and a love for the whole watershed and every creature in it is kind of given to him by this big female Chinook salmon. Before I wrote that scene, I had that experience with a steelhead that I hooked when I was fishing for trout with a light leader, and that's where the scene came from. And then many years later, I'd just done a big salmon event in Portland where I was a keynote and went down to one of the coastal streams, which I won't name until I'm on the other side of the grass. Then I'll tell the people I meet there. But I hooked, well, it was a 40-inch Chinook, so it was probably close to, when they're that long, they tend to weigh about a pound an inch. Well, this fish, it was a long battle. I hooked it on a fly, and I thought I'd hook with salt. And it was a long battle, and when I got the fish in my hands, I mean, there was just no way I could have harmed it, even though I was in a place where that was perfectly legal and had, you know, every fishermanly right to do it. At the end of the fight, she did three tail walks that were like 20 feet across the surface of the pool, that she had that much energy after she'd already expended so much. Just, again, it was, that species has just often blown my mind. And when I took her out into the current, standing in about thigh-deep water, I was holding her to make sure she'd gotten her full energy back. And just holding her as she moved her tail, she was so big and strong, even weakened by the battle, that my whole body was moving back and forth. And I don't dance, but I was dancing then. And when I released her, I mean, she shot off. It's like her energy was instantly back, and she shot off with speed, and watching her just melt into the never-named river was really a sweet experience. And I think just thinking how many could be having such experiences if this folly ended is how I would like to end this conversation. So thanks for listening.
I'm sitting here on the edge of the main salmon river in Idaho. We are at Reed Camp, right below Reed Rapid, which you can hear in the background. It's a very loud rapid. I'm sitting in the shade with Linwood Lougheed. He is a conservationist and a former chair of the board of directors for Advocates of the West, who moved with his family in 1948 to Lewiston, Idaho. Since then, he has observed the development of the Snake River. Linwood has done a lot for conservation, but he also played a major role in preventing ExxonMobil from transporting giant mining machinery to the oil fields in Canada via the Clearwater Locksaw Wild and Scenic River Corridor. Linwood, we are on a salmon recovery writing workshop right now with David James Duncan. You're also a writer, as well as being a conservationist. And you are currently fighting to save salmon and steelhead from extinction. Could you tell us a little bit more about the importance of these species of fish and what's going on?
Well, for openers, this is not called the Snake River or the Bluebonnet River. This is the Salmon River, but it's soon to be a river without salmon. Before the Europeans entered the scene in the Pacific Northwest, the estimate is that there were 16 million anadromous fish that came into the Columbia Basin. And half of that number were being produced by the Snake River. And the Snake River's principal tributary is the Salmon River. And so 16 million fish. And today we might hit 1.5 million, you know. And the first crisis for the salmon was the overfishing done by canneries along the lower Columbia. And they hammered this fish. So, of course, the population dropped off significantly. The next major issue arose in 1947. And the government decided they wanted to bring freight transportation to Lewiston, Idaho, where I grew up, and Clarkston, Washington. And so that was going to require four dams. The Corps of Engineers was told that in order to get final permission to the 1947 45 legislation, they had to prove that it was beneficial cost-wise, that it was a cost beneficial, and they couldn't do it. And they would add some more counties. And before long, we were hauling, I mean, their wheat was being hauled, you know, practically out of North Dakota or something in order to get that. And they still couldn't get it. So then they said, well, we consider bass worth 26 cents a pound. And we know this is going to bring in a lot of bass. Nobody put a value on the salmon at all. So they finally came up with a 1.1 to 1 cost-benefit ratio. That was achieved when they said that if they didn't build the dams, it would require 4 big steam plants in order to provide the electricity that the dams would provide. They failed to tell us that nobody wanted that electricity. It was, there's no need for it. But that was what, you know, got them approval. So they started building those dams in 1962. Ice Harbor was the first one. And before they did, the Department of Fish and Game in Idaho, Oregon's Department of Fish and Game, Washington's Department of Fish and Game, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service all told the Corps this could eliminate completely the salmon and steelhead runs on the Columbia and Snake River. Well, the Corps, of course, it always knows best, and so they started building the dams. And that was in 62, and immediately the salmon numbers started to drop. Every dam that went in, the salmon numbers dropped. And they plunged, really plunged. And so that led then to trying to tweak the dams and, you know, various ways and just trying to improve the structures. They spent over $1 billion. The salmon and steelhead in the 1990s became listed under the Endangered Species Act. And so it was that bad, you know. On the Salmon River, which hosts the major run of sockeye salmon, one year the return to Redfish Lake was one fish. And they called him Lonesome Larry. And so now we have spent over $17 billion. When I say we, both the ratepayers for electricity and the taxpayers spent $17 billion, and our fish are in crisis, and their best plan of Bonneville Power and the Corps of Engineers is to keep doing what we've been doing for 30 years. And it's crazy, absolutely crazy. And people are starting to recognize, I think, that salmon is not just a product. It's just not something you buy at the grocery store and eat. It has spiritual value as well as a food resource for our tribes in the Pacific Northwest. And it can bring in lots of money from visitors to eastern Washington and Idaho to fish for these wonderful creatures. And I guess the real bottom line in this regard is, you know, do we want to be the generation or the group of people that let the salmon go extinct? And I just don't think we could do that. And I guess I'm still hopeful. I've been fighting this fight for quite a few years. We have more people now throughout the Pacific Northwest increasing their awareness of the salmon and the issue. And all of the scientific studies show that the salmon will never recover unless those dams come out. And that's all reputable scientists in the Northwest. Once in a while, there's a study from some outfit, one scientist that produces something for the PNWA, Pacific Northwest Waterways Association, or other groups like that. And it's just a big scam. And what is really concerning in an irritating way for me is that the Corps of Engineers and the Bonneville Power Administration is using tax money, our money, to mount the largest propaganda campaign that I've seen in the Northwest anyway. The conservation community and the tribes are trying to put out the truth, and the other side doesn't seem to care about the truth. It's a little like the Trump years, you know. Truth, what's truth? And so we're facing, from an extinction standpoint, some of these rivers are already biologically extinct. And by that I mean that there are so few salmon with that DNA that go up that specific fork that it's doubtful if they can recover, even with the dams out. But I guess there's always hope, or I try to think there's hope. And I know people are up in arms, and the politicians are starting to pay attention.
And I hope everyone listening is also paying attention and realizing that you can speak up on behalf of salmon. But not only salmon, we're also talking about the recovery of steelhead. Let's talk a little bit about the magic of the steelhead. You are an angler. Today you rode in my raft and you told me about some phenomenal fishing adventures up in Alaska when you lived in the Bristol Bay Area. I just want to talk to you about steelhead because, for me, this is one of the most amazing creatures in the world. Not only do they explore rivers, but they also explore oceans. And I just would love if you could reflect on that fish a little bit.
Well, there are two types of steelhead, A and B. And the A steelhead are smaller, and the B steelhead are the big kind of classical fish that people loved. And, you know, you're getting steelhead up to 31 pounds. I think that was the state record at one point anyway. Well, the main nursery for the B run of Snake River steelhead was the North Fork. North Fork, the Clearwater River. And so the Corps decided that it would really be a great thing if it was turned into a lake. And so they destroyed the river, built a dam 700 feet tall, way too tall ever to have fish ladders. So today you can go to what was the North Fork of the Clearwater River and maybe catch kokanee that run 10, 11, 12 inches, or it's good bass fishing because, of course, the water warms. And so basically that run is lost forever. Well, close to forever. 700 foot of concrete is a lot of concrete. That's a sad story. I used to go up on the North Fork and fish for steelhead, and it was just this wonderful place. There was a fight at that time, too, over whether that dam should be built, but the federal government won out, so to speak. And Frank Church, I remember I visited with Frank one evening, and he admitted that was a mistake. I mean, he had supported it. The economy of the area there around Orfino has always been really, really bad. And so everybody thought this was going to be an economic boon. Well, if they could have the North Fork back, then they would have an economic boon, you know. There's a kind of an interesting issue in terms of the dams allow cruise ships to come to Clarkston, Washington. And these are not big cruisers, but, you know, they hold 65 maybe to 200 people. And the Port of Clarkston argues that this brings in $4 million to the local economy. Well, that's probably an overstatement because these people don't stay in a hotel. They have their hotel. You know, they already paid for it. They don't eat in the restaurants. They have wonderful food on ship. And they don't go to bars. I mean, they have a bar on the ship. And a lot of them fly into Spokane and are picked up by a bus and brought down to Clarkston. They do their day a tour, and at the same time, the bus takes returning home people to the airport in Spokane via bus, you know. But anyway, I said, okay, we can take that $4 million. That's okay. It was 3 years ago, I think. It looked like the state was not going to even have a steelhead season. You know, I thought, well, gee, maybe Lewiston, they always had a big weekend for prizes and so forth. And I said, maybe they could have for the biggest carp, you know. I mean, wouldn't that be exciting? We'd draw a lot of people to come fish for carp, I'm sure. So anyway, Idaho Department of Labor came out with the figure, and they said the loss of the steelhead season in Idaho would cost $8.1 million per month. And there's a six-month season, typically, and so we're talking about almost $50 million. And that's just steelhead, and we're not talking salmon. And, you know, all the studies that have been done show that the potential for economic value of those fish is just tremendous, really tremendous. But like I say, to me, it's the whole spirit of the thing, and a response to a government that's doing stupid things and refusing to come up with what needs to be done. In fact, this is something that people should understand. For a long time, the criterion that we were all supposed to be working toward was recovery of the runs. In the last few analyses, the government has changed the goalpost. Now the goal is to keep them from going extinct. Well, now those are two very different goals, you know. Sockeye, a couple years ago, they had to truck sockeye to the hatchery in a pickup. And you can think of that, this noble creature, you know, in the back of a pickup. But, you know, there's just a lot of crap going on and people aren't telling the truth.
It was while we were living internationally, about 11 years ago, that Explorer Maps first started, when Chris and his brother Greg decided to join forces and bring the maps to the whole wide world. Hi, this is Vanessa, Chris's wife. Each map is a labor of love, and I am lucky enough to see them all grow step by step from the early research and planning stages onto a large white piece of paper, through penciling, inking, and finally seeing the real magic happen as Chris adds the color. As each one reaches the end phase, I get to examine them closely in the hope that I spot any unfinished bits before Chris sends them off. But there's always new illustrations to see every time. I love going to the Missoula warehouse when we're in Montana to see each unique map on the incredible range of products that Explorer Maps now has. Having lived away from home and families for the past 17 years, our aim of connecting people and place is very poignant to me. And for that reason, my favorite maps are Flathead and the Maasai Mara, because these two places are central to our extended family gatherings and where we have made the best of memories. Which map will you get to help you treasure your own special times? Please be sure to use the promo code Mandela for a discount when you visit exploremaps.com.
Hi, this is Lynn Lahey again. A friend of mine, a dear friend that I have known for many years, recently reached the age of 93, and I said, Bill, we really need to hear your stories. And his name is Bill Chetwood, and he grew up in Kamei, and as a teenager began fishing for steelhead. First, he was using grease line, and he didn't know that you could catch them with flies, but they would catch them sometimes when they were fishing for trout. And so he worked on learning to tie flies. They would fish for steelhead at night in a more or less a method that was perfected by the Nez Perce, in which they used a drift boat and a jig, and they would have a torch in front of the drift boat and two oarsmen and two other men that could get a hook into a steelhead. You know, later Bill became a total diehard fly fisher, and he looks back on the days when they would take the salmon at night, attracting them with a light. And I asked him how he felt about that, and he said, that's just the way it was. That's how we did it in those days. And Bill has shared his story with me, and it's recorded, and I look forward to sharing it with you as well. And in fact, I'm going to play that, the first of two films, right now.
My name is William E. Chetwood. My last name, C-H-E-T-W-O-O-D. Well, we moved to Kamei in 1936, and we lived in a small farm outside of Kamei, and started school that year, and I graduated from high school there in 1948. And our activities there were mostly outdoor, and we had a lot of activity associated with the river. And it was about 100 kids in high school, 14 in our graduating class, that sort of thing. So a small population. Well, as a fisherman, I got into that because of my dad was a fly fisherman, and he didn't tie his own flies, but he bought flies at the hardware store used telescoping bamboo rods, and we fished the lochs on the Selway. And I got interested in steelhead because we used to fish for these large trout up on the Selway and the Locksaw, and all of a sudden, well, you'd lose your whole outfit with the fish just clean you off, and we finally figured out it was a steelhead, and they'd come up and take a fly. And so that was my first introduction to fishing for steelhead with a fly rod. Interesting you raise the question about fishing with lights and spears and spearing steelhead. We learned that, somebody learned it from somebody else, and I assume we learned it from the Nez Perce. And we had double-ended boats that we floated the Clearwater between Kami and Kuski at night. And we would have a man in each end of that double-ended boat, a guy running the oars in the middle, and we would use pitch torches for light because we didn't have the artificial light otherwise, and we would spear the silver flash we see in the water. And these were what we called gigs, and they had three or four hooks on the end of each spear, so you had a better chance of hooking a steelhead at that time. So we'd float at night, and by midnight, we'd have three or four, five, six steelhead in the boat. And that was the way it went. Well, to begin with, the Northwest Steelheaders Association was opposed to the building of the Dorshack Dam. So I was part of the Northwest Steelheaders Association through the fact that my dad was one of the charter members, and the Roby boys were really active in it, and the Altmillers from Orfino, and those people were really active in this movement to try to keep Dorshack Dam from being developed. And we thought that it was going to damage the fishery. And so we became very interested in not having any obstruction of those waterways. And so we were very active opposing dams. The thing that I can remember about fishing the North Fork was that Jake Altmiller and the Robies figured out a way to catch these North Fork steelhead. So they needed the boat, and they had a 12-foot rowboat they put a motor on, and they built a cage around the prop so that the rocks wouldn't beat the prop up too bad, and they'd go through three or four props on every fishing trip. But anyway, they built a cage around that, and they started fishing the North Fork for the steelhead at that time, before that dam was ever in. And there were some really big B-run fish in the North Fork. Well, first time I ever caught a steelhead in the Selway River, I did it with a grab hook. And we'd stand in shallow water and wait for one to come in, and then we'd grab it, and we'd catch a couple of steelhead and take them home, and that was the way we did that. Well, when I got a little older and got the idea of catching them on a hook and line, I started talking to some people that used the Atlantic salmon greased line fishing with flies. And these guys could catch Atlantic salmon on fly, so we figured out, hell, you could catch a steelhead on a fly, surely, because we knew we'd lost some fly fishing gear while fishing for trout up there. So we started using the Atlantic salmon greased line technique on steelhead, tying our own flies, and we finally got, I remember I went out 13 times that first year before I ever hooked a steelhead on a fly. And it was a long time. I just never, couldn't think of ever to do it. But once I got the knack of it, I got so that I could catch several steelhead if I wanted to put the time in there on a floating line with a small fly. There's a guy from Pennsylvania, not here. His name is Ed Jaworowski. And Ed Jaworowski is a professor of Latin studies at Villanova University. And I first introduced him to steelhead fishing. He's used to fishing in Europe to the Atlantic salmon with flies, so he wanted to do that with steelhead. So he came out, and we fished the Rond, and we fished the Clearwater, and we fished the Salmon River, and to great success, because the guy is an absolute magical flycaster. However, he watches this program of what we're trying to preserve and what we're not getting done, and the fact that all these dams in the East Coast have destroyed the Atlantic salmon runs, and they've got some kind of a subsidy on that one. And he says, is there anything you guys can do out there? Because he's brought several of his friends with him when he comes to fish for steelhead for flies. And he is not coming back. And he said, I really hate that because now I'm retired and I got some time and got some money to spend. So anyway, he's not coming back because of the dearth of opportunity. I do represent a very large and very dedicated bunch of people by being here. I know that, and I know that from thinking back historically, the people that I used to fish with, the fishermen, the old-timers, and so on. Being here to speak continually for something that they worked so hard for and died before it happened, I feel a certain responsibility and a privilege. And so thank you, and whoever is getting the knowledge and the facts out to people, those people are more important than me. The fact that I've been here a long time just means that I'm old. It doesn't mean I know anything, but I've seen it all. And I tell you, we can't continue unless we're willing to give up these anadromous fish runs and the most important part of our environment. I'm a little disappointed in some things and a little heartened in some of the information as it comes out, and there's always hope.
Hello, my name is Diana, and I'm here on the near the middle fork of the Salmon River and watching for the salmon that are making their way up to the headwaters, making their way up to their spawning beds for which they came from. It's sad to see that there's very little coming back and that they are struggling to be here, but that's their life. That's what they needed to do. That back in 1879, the Tukarika, the bighorn sheep eaters and the salmon eaters were removed out of here. We are Shoshone people. We are removed out of these mountains forever. And it's sad to see that our salmon, what we call agai, is disappearing. They're not as plentiful as they are. They were a long time ago when Tukareka Agaideka was here. And a lot of it has to do with all the obstacles they have to endure to get from the ocean back to their home where they were born. That the salmon have great significance to our people. They are a part of the spiritual part of our world, of our culture. And it would be important for our people to experience what our ancestors at Tukareka Agaideka saw a long time ago. That we can see the stories and all of the pictographs and all of the history that is left here on the Middle Fork. But it would be, I think it would be an honor within my lifetime to know that we can restore a culture, restore the spirituality of our people, of our native people, in the restoration of our fish. We'll send that. Thank you.
Namaste, Missoula. Mandela here, your host of The Trail Less Traveled. The Trail Less Traveled is the Trail 103.3's locally harvested adventure radio series and the community source for adventure information and inspiration. The show premieres every Sunday evening at 6 Mountain Time. You can stream the show live online at trail1033.com. I would like to thank my guests for this week: David James Duncan, Linwood Lawhey, Bill Chetwood, and Diana, a Shoshone elder whom I met while guiding on the Middle Fork of the Salmon. She was watching for the return of the salmon. Before the Snake River dams were built, millions and millions of salmon and steelhead used to swim 900 miles from the Pacific Ocean to Redfish Lake in Idaho in order to spawn. Diana told me that this year, so far, she's only seen one. These interviews were recorded while floating down the main fork and the middle fork of the Salmon River in the Frank Church Wilderness of No Return. My adventure tip this week is to get informed and speak up on behalf of the critically endangered salmon and steelhead of the Pacific Northwest. You can find out more information online. And then please do use your voice to speak up for these iconic species before they go extinct. That's it for this week's adventure, my friends in Missoula and around the world. But until next week, please get outside. Do something for the Earth. I would like to take a moment to thank a small family business based in Missoula, Montana, for their full support of the podcast version of the show and my international outreach programs. Explore Maps. Explore Maps and the Trail Less Traveled are partnering up to connect people and place. I hope to see you for Cartography Comes Alive on March 20th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. For the first time, I'm going to be speaking publicly about swimming 225 miles of the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon using a riverboard during the pandemic. And you can learn more by visiting exploremaps.com.